Jill Fritz with the Humane Society of the United States, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Village Building Convergence from June 10th to 18th, 2023. This is an annual community building event bringing together community members and neighborhoods to engage in grassroots placemaking and sustainable community building throughout Portland. More information on how to get involved in this year's Village Building Convergence can be found on the website, villagebuildingconvergence.com.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender, justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll examine the federal charges that former President Donald Trump is facing around his acquisition of classified documents, his refusal to turn them over, his incriminating statements made about them in the presence of others, and more. My guest will be retired judge and Truth Take contributor Bill Blum. Then Vaughn Martin of Center for Popular Democracy Action will explain why climate activists braved hazardous air last week to gather in front of the White House demanding President Joe Biden cancel the Mountain Valley Pipeline project in West Virginia and others like it in Alaska and the Gulf Coast. Finally, author and speaker Frank Forensich will describe the impact that purpose-driven activism has on our mental and physical health. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Activism is Medicine, Health and Relevance for the Human Animal. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Donald Trump appeared in a Miami court on Tuesday, becoming the first former president ever to be arraigned on federal charges. He's been indicted on multiple counts of illegally holding on to national security documents after leaving office, blocking efforts to retrieve the documents, and lying about them. The indictments include photographic images of documents haphazardly being stored in boxes in various unsecured locations at his Florida resort. The judge that Trump faces, who was apparently randomly assigned to the case, is one Eileen Cannon, who made headlines last year for her pro-Trump interference when the former president requested the appointment of a special master in a case around the FBI's seizure of documents from Mar-a-Lago. We turn now to Bill Blum, retired judge, novelist, writer, and lecturer at USC Annenberg School of Communications and UCLA. He's also a contributor to TruthDig.com. Welcome to the program, Bill.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to be with you.
So, you know, we never thought this time would come. Here, Trump is facing federal charges. These are unprecedented because the charges that he faced in the Manhattan court are not federal charges, correct? Let's talk about the unprecedented nature of what it is that he's facing.
Yes. I've always expected that Donald would be charged. So that's one thing that differentiates me from some commentators. I've been writing about him since 2015 when he announced his first presidential campaign. And one of the things I've noticed about Donald is that he's his own worst enemy when it comes to the law. This is an historic turning point in American law because he's the first former president who has been indicted federally for the commission of crimes. He could have avoided this indictment simply by returning the documents that don't belong to him to the National Archives when they requested them. But he hasn't, and instead he's embarked on this Alice in Wonderland parade of pseudo defenses, among which is the claim that the documents belong to him, that he declassified them in his mind, and that he could show them to whomever he wished. And all of that is not going to serve him well in a court of law. So this is a long time coming, to be sure, but I thought it was a slow train coming and that the train eventually arrives at the station.
So when we think about the documents involved, I mean, it's easy to, for the right especially, to dismiss them because Hillary Clinton was accused of improperly storing classified information. Even Biden and Obama have been, you know, it's been pointed out that they took documents that they shouldn't have. But these are, they're not equal, right? So what is particularly egregious about the documents that Trump took?
Well, Donald is alleged to have taken and then refused to return the documents upon demand. That's different from Biden, who has the public information thus far is that when documents were discovered in his home and in an office, he let the federal government in to search the office and search his home, and then voluntarily released any of the documents found. So Donald, on the other hand, knew that the documents were classified. And of course, under the Espionage Act, they don't even have to be classified, but he knew that they were classified. He took them anyway. And then he refused repeatedly to return them. And he engaged in a shell game where he moved the documents from the ballroom at Mar-a-Lago to the bathroom, to the business center, and then up to Bedminster. And all the while claiming that he owned the documents under the Presidential Records Act, and that's nonsense. Under the Presidential Records Act, the documents became the property of the US government upon the transfer of power to the next president. Now, as to Hillary, I was very, very critical back in the day when she was exposed as using a private email server to conduct business as Secretary of State. But she was investigated both by the FBI under Obama and then later three times by the Justice Department and the State Department under Trump. And it was found that there was no systemic mishandling of classified information. To this day, she claims that she didn't know that there was any classified information on her emails. Somewhat debatable as to whether or not any of the emails had classified markings on them, but I think it's clear that some of the emails contained classified information, but they couldn't prove that she intended to violate the law, which now they appear to be able to do with Donald Trump if you read the indictment. The indictment is a speaking indictment. It's very detailed and it's very damning. And if the government is able to prove the allegations set forth in the indictment, I don't see that Donald Trump is going to avoid a guilty verdict. Unless, and this is the other part of what you asked me, the judge in the case, Eileen Cannon, sabotages the prosecution, which is a possibility.
In fact, you know, if you think about Donald Trump's dumb luck, he couldn't have gotten luckier in this case than to land Eileen Cannon, who was randomly assigned. She has been, you know, I mean, MSNBC calls her, quote unquote, loose cannon because of her actions, unprecedented actions last year in agreeing to Trump's request to assign a special master. I'm not a legal expert, so I, you know, don't know the ins and outs of this. But judging by her actions as someone who is a legal expert, Bill, how worried are you that she's not quite fit to handle this particular case?
I don't think she's at all fit to handle the case, and I think she should recuse herself. There's a federal statute found at Title 28 of the United States Code, Section 455, that requires a judge to recuse any time her impartiality can be reasonably questioned. It certainly can be reasonably questioned based on the rulings that she issued with regard to the search and seizure that occurred in August at Mar-a-Lago. So I'm very concerned. I think that this judge is a MAGA activist. She's been a Federalist Society member since 2005. Her rulings were condemned by the conservative 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. So she really should recuse herself, and I'm astonished that her selection was random. Apparently there are six judges in the local district where this case is being tried. So she had a 1 in 6 chance of being the judge selected, and lo and behold, she's the judge selected.
But who will question her fitness? I mean, if she's a MAGA activist, there's no way that she's going to recuse herself. And if somebody with authority questions her, the Trumpers will simply say there's more political interference, and this just proves our case that this whole thing is a quote-unquote witch hunt.
Well, that's true. They will. I think that if you're Jack Smith and his prosecution team, you have to disregard what the MAGA activists are going to say.
So, and Jack Smith is the federal prosecutor. Is it up to him to call into question her judgment on this case and ask for her to be recused?
Yes, they can do it in any number of ways. I think it's a question of when rather than if. And what I mean by that is that I don't think you do it on the first day of the proceedings that are assigned to her. You wait for her to do something particularly outrageous, and then you request that she recuse herself. And if she declines, you file what's called a petition for writ of mandamus to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, asking them to intervene and to remove her from the case. It's going to depend on what she does. Maybe she'll toe the line. That's possible. The mere fact that she was appointed by Donald Trump doesn't disqualify her. What disqualifies her is the incredibly biased way she handled the search and seizure.
Now, among the among the charges that Trump is facing is that he implicated himself. There's all this incriminating evidence on record about the fact that he knew the documents he was handling were classified and that he was handling them in front of people who were not authorized to see them. And I'm wondering if you can dig into them, because, you know, rather than worrying about the sensitive nature about the documents themselves, it seems to be a good indication of the hubris that this, and, you know, just the gall of this former president who really seems to believe he's above the law.
Well, that's right. In his own words, he's saying a couple of things in the interview. I think you're referring to in particular the one that's excerpted. I think it's at paragraph 54 of the, or maybe I'm wrong on the exact number, where he's talking to a publisher, a writer. They're working on a book for Mark Meadows and two staff members. And he's waving allegedly a classified document regarding attack plans, contingency plans on Iran. And he says, I could have declassified this, but I didn't, and now I can't. So what he's saying there is that he understands that there's a process that has to be undertaken to declassify documents. So it blows out of the water this ridiculous claim that he can declassify anything just in his mind. And it doesn't help him anyway, because if you think about it, if he's saying that I declassified the documents, that means that he knew that at one time they were classified. And that distinguishes him from Hillary's claims, where she's saying, I never knew that the things on my server were classified. So he doesn't help himself. The best advice any lawyer could give Donald Trump in this case and in the other cases is to shut his mouth. And that's one thing he can't do. Another thing he can't do is he can't take the witness stand in his own defense, because if he does, he'll be subjected to cross-examination and he will further incriminate himself. So let's say he wants to float a defense that I declassified this particular document, even though that's not particularly relevant, and I can do with it whatever I want. He's going to have to be the one who takes the stand and testifies under penalty of perjury that he did that, because no one else is going to be able to know what he did in his mind except himself.
Let's. Yes. I want to think about, again, the unprecedented nature of what's happening this week and whether that will be something that plays to the former president's advantage. I mean, we should actually just come out and say the words. He was arrested, right? We have a former president who was arrested,
right.
Booked, fingerprinted. I don't know if they did mugshots. And that's never in the history of this country, not a very long history, admittedly, that has never happened. Will the fact that it is so unprecedented play to Trump's advantage? Because there is no playbook, really, is there, for how one proceeds on these things? Or is that overblown?
Well, you have to distinguish between the political and the legal. Legally, I think that he's in a world of jeopardy, subject to Judge Cannon's treatment and the Supreme Court's review of it, if it gets to the Supreme Court, and the delay that it will take for all of this to play out. That's key to understand. His main weapon right now, in my view, is to delay the proceedings until perhaps he's reelected, which gets me into the political aspect
right.
of this. And I think that with the MAGA base, this is only going to solidify their support for him. But the question is, how strong is that MAGA base in a general election? And even is the MAGA base shrinking within the Republican Party? There's some small indication that maybe there's a little bit of shrinkage within the party, but I don't think that there will be to a significant extent. Trump is the leader of one of our two political parties, and that party has now embraced authoritarianism. I call it a kind of neo-fascism, but let's just call it illiberal, anti-democratic for the time being. And it plays with them. So will it benefit him politically? In the short run, yes. Maybe in the long run too. One of the unprecedented natures of this charge is that a case against the president is likely to become a central issue in the 2024 election. So it's not just lock her up. You know, maybe in the future we'll lock up a presidential candidate. It's whether or not this case should go forward and whether or not this case is a witch hunt. And you can expect the MAGA zealots like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Jim Jordan to distort the record as vociferously and as much as they can. And they're going to pull in people who at one time were a little bit more sane, like Lindsey Graham. So this is truly unprecedented. This is the intersection of law and politics writ large. And I don't know how it's all going to conclude. But just to summarize from a legal standpoint, very strong case. Trump's going to try to delay and delay and delay, hoping that he wins. And if he wins, he'll just call off the dogs. The Justice Department will drop the case. In any event, they can't proceed against the sitting president. And his ace in the hole is this crazy notion that he can pardon himself. So delay, delay until maybe he gets elected. And then politically is to ride the coattails of this witch hunt to the nomination and then into the general election. And of course, he's facing a candidate who has a pretty good legislative record. I've never been a great Joe Biden fan, but I have to acknowledge he's gotten a lot of things done. But he's already 80 years old. In a way, it reminds me, and I don't want to draw the analogy too directly or specifically, but in a way, it reminds me of a young Adolf Hitler squaring off against Hindenburg, who was just too darn old to hold him off.
Wow.
It's very important.
Do the charges against Trump disqualify him from running for president? And if he's actually, and if not, if he's actually convicted, would they prevent him from running? If
great
the conviction
questions.
Happened before he ran for president?
I don't think these charges would disqualify him from running as a matter of law. He'd have to be convicted of something like inciting the insurrection, which he's, I think there's very, very high likelihood that he'll get indicted for a J6 related action. I don't know if it'll be inciting the insurrection or conspiring to overturn the results of the election. Maybe something along those lines could. Of course, Congress could try to disqualify him under the 14th Amendment, but that's not going to happen. This is divided Congress, so I don't think that's going to take place. So the short answer is, and this is my best guess, is that no, it wouldn't disqualify him from certainly running and holding office. You know, he'll just let's say he's convicted before the election and he's elected, he'll just pardon himself.
If,
and then the Supreme Court will have to deal with that.
If it was not a former sitting president facing these charges and potentially getting convicted, do these charges come with prison time?
Oh, yes, they do. But they're not mandatory. If you look at the last few pages of the indictment, that's a penalty sheet, they're all listed. So the greatest single term under any one count is 20 years. And if you add them all in the event that he was sentenced consecutively on all the counts, it would be 100 years. But there's no mandatory minimum. So he does not have to go to prison. And people who are on television saying that he will die in prison are getting way over their skis. I don't know that he'd go to prison at all. Maybe he'd be sentenced to home confinement at Mar-a-Lago. Can you think of something more terrible than that?
So you mentioned that there's already moves that he's already talking about and potentially trying to ride out the clock in the hopes that he might become president again and pardon himself. There are other Republican hopefuls, presidential hopefuls, that are also touting this, right? Like to prove their allegiance to the leader, to the king, that were they to become president, they would pardon Trump
of
any
course.
And all charges
yes.
that he faces.
Yes.
I mean, it's just... there seems to be no end to the sort of shamelessness around this issue, because there are folks who want to see him completely pardoned of all charges, as Trump can do no wrong. Like, he can literally he's not capable of committing a crime in their minds.
The way to understand Donald Trump is that he is the leader of an authoritarian cult. Really, the best way to understand him, you read people like Jason Stanley and Robert Paxton and Ruth Ben-Ghiat, is that he's the leader of a fascist movement. And the movement pledges unstinting loyalty to the leader. And those who stand outside of that cult, who are still in the Republican Party, come at some point to make what Ruth Ben-Ghiat calls an authoritarian bargain, where they abandon their loyalty to democratic principles, and they say, well, you know, the balance is, if the choice is between the Democratic Party and the potential that it represents for multicultural democracy and the Republican Party under Donald Trump, which will preserve all the privileges of the capitalist elite, they make the choice in favor of Donald Trump. That's the authoritarian bargain, and that happens throughout history in many different countries in which authoritarian leaders come to power through the democratic process and then overturn democracy. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid we're on the cusp of that happening now. And the urgency of the matter requires people to see it through a lens like that. If you don't want to put the label fascist on them, put the label authoritarian on them, but see it in that way.
Bill, it's not just Trump who faces charges, but also his aide, Walt Nauta. There's also reports that Trump has had trouble finding lawyers to represent him. You know, these are not minor charges, as we've been talking about. He's facing 38 charges. At the very least, you hope that that these legal troubles will distract the president, former president, from a campaign, because, you know, he can't just walk away from them. He can't just absolve himself in his mind. and also does the fact that he's having trouble finding lawyers suggest that he's becoming too hot to handle, too much for people to associate with?
Yes, he is having trouble getting a legal team together. He's charged with 37 counts. Nauta is charged with one separate account to make the 38 count indictment, just as a technical matter. He does have two good lawyers, Todd Blanche and Chris Kreese, who are on the case, but he needs a Florida-based team, and apparently many Florida-based lawyers have just declined to work for him because he's a nightmare client. He can't be controlled. And I wouldn't be surprised if these two who are on his team right now at some point have a falling out with him. So, and he can't ignore this case. He's going to have to, if the case goes to trial, he's going to have to sit through the trial. He's going to have to be present. It's not like E. Jean Carroll's case in New York, which is a civil case, which he didn't attend. You know, he's also going to go on trial in a big civil case in New York in October of this year. That trial date's already set. I don't know whether he will boycott that trial or not. That's going to cost him a lot more money than E. Jean Carroll cost him.
Right. And those were the E. Jean Carroll ones were basically him being accused of rape. Right. Well, then finally, there's one big question that has been popping up in the minds of some analysts, which is, what was his motive? and why did he do what he did? He didn't have to hold on to these documents other than for, I don't know, souvenir purposes. Is he simply, as you were saying earlier, his own worst enemy, or is there anything deeper at work here?
Yeah, we don't know what his motive was. He was asked that on the town hall that CNN hosted, and he simply said, I could take them. I decided to take them. They're my documents. We don't know why. In the New York Review of Books, writer Fintan O'Toole has an article in which he points out, in essence, that Trump's a very transactional person. So why did he take the documents? Did he take them just to thumb his nose at the Biden administration? Did he take them just because he could? Or did he take them because he hoped to use them in transactional dealings with, I don't know, say Saudi Arabia?
Bill, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Always a pleasure to have you on.
It's always great to be with you.
My guest has been Bill Blum. He is a retired judge, novelist, writer, and lecturer at USC Annenberg School of Communications and UCLA, and a contributor to truthdig.com. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Climate activists braved hazardous air last week in Washington, D.C. to gather outside the White House and demand that President Joe Biden cancel the Mountain Valley Pipeline and declare a climate emergency. As smoke from major Canadian wildfires enveloped the nation's capital and large parts of the East Coast, climate activists pointed out that such environmental crises will only accelerate with the approval of the West Virginia project. My guest is Vaughn Martin, Deputy Chief of Campaigns at the Center for Popular Democracy Action. Welcome to the program, Vaughn.
Thank you so much for having us, Sonali.
So let's first talk about what this project is. We've had so many various pipelines over the years that activists have popped up in opposition to, you know, the Dakota Access Pipeline, we've got Line 3. And it seems as though every single time such a pipeline pops up, no matter whether it's a Democratic or Republican president, these pipelines have a way of getting through and just have a lot of momentum behind them. So this particular one, the Mountain Valley Pipeline, is in West Virginia, where the Democrats do have a senator, albeit one who tends to side with Republicans. Why is this a problematic project?
Well, let me start with this, Sonali. What we saw in New York and in the Northeast was really a stark and sobering reminder and proof that we're actually living in a climate emergency. And the Movement Valley Pipeline and all the other projects that Biden continues to approve continue to put the climate emergency right at our doorstep. And when you follow the science, the trail leads to fossil fuel reliance and corporate greed. What we know is that with this climate emergency at our doorstep, the Mountain Valley Pipeline and projects like it will continue to create disasters across this country. We know that humanity is at a crossroads, and the first to face the worst of the crisis will inevitably be Black, Latine, working class, immigrant folks, and the Global South. We've already begun to witness this. Year after year, we see record-breaking heat waves, droughts, freak ice storms and mega hurricanes and floods. So what this pipeline does, what projects in the Gulf do, they continue to put us in harm's way, continue to put Black and brown people and folks who are at the front line in harm's way. And it's only the beginning of what we'll see if we do not act immediately.
So there was obviously deep irony there with activists, you know, having to brave the terrible air. We've seen apocalyptic images coming from the East Coast over the past week. Of course, by now, as you and I are speaking, it has cleared up. Those wildfires that caused the air, they weren't taking place in the places where people were breathing. They were taking place in Canada. And of course, we share an atmosphere. The wind is blowing all of this pollution across state lines, across national boundaries. And it just seems so highly symbolic that climate change is a global phenomenon, right? And that wildfires are linked to pipeline projects, even if the power brokers and the decision makers don't want us to link those with one another.
No, exactly. We know that as the largest emitter of carbon dioxide, the United States should be at the forefront, right? Leading the way to fully transition us off of fossil fuels. And we know that we have to act within the next 6 years. And this means demanding a climate emergency and demanding that the Biden administration put a stop to our fossil fuel reliance and to the projects that continue to put us in harm's way. We, you know, as a species, like, we're at a critical decision point that will determine whether we live into a thriving future or one filled with death and uncertainty. And these kinds of projects, right, that continue to emit these harmful chemicals are going to be essential for us to stop in the next 6 years.
Now, one of the issues with the Mountain Valley Pipeline is that it is a natural gas pipeline. The term natural gas is so misleading, perhaps by design, and it was during the Obama administration that it was being touted as transitionary fuel. This is often fuel that's produced as a result of fracking, and it was supposed to be, at least as per Obama, and of course at that time Vice President Biden, fracked gas was supposed to be a transition away from fossil fuels in general. But of course, it didn't do that. It was quite the opposite, right? Like, we have like more fracked gas. We have a glut of this material at a time when we have to stop burning fossil fuels. So is the Biden administration using the fact that this is a natural gas pipeline to try to justify its approval?
Well, there's a lot of rhetoric and misinformation out there, but you know, the reality is Biden promised to be a climate president, right? And as you mentioned, under his watch, the U.S. continues to be the biggest producer of oil and gas in the world. And the first few years of his term, he approved more oil and gas drilling on federal lands and waters than President Trump. And his administration has approved new oil and gas projects, like we just mentioned, the Willow oil drilling project in Alaska. We have gas export terminals in the Gulf, and it goes on from there, right? And it's really clear, global scientists and frontline communities, we know that we cannot avoid the very worst impacts of the climate crisis if we allow for any more fossil fuel development, right? Our stance is that our planet is on fire and we can't feed this fire any longer.
And the reason why activists gathered in the hazardous polluted air last week was because the Mountain Valley Pipeline had been fast-tracked in the debt ceiling deal, hidden, you know, in there. This pipeline that should have had debate and discussion was slipped in as a concession, you know, and this is the kind of thing that happens often. I suppose the Biden administration and lawmakers hoped that people wouldn't notice, but people did notice. Tell me about the activism that took place. There was a week of actions across the country in dozens of locations, not just against the Mountain Valley Pipeline, but as you were mentioning, some of the Alaska projects too?
Exactly. So the June week of actions are only a kickoff to an entire summer of action. This week, there are 2,000 plus people who have signed up to take action, over 67 actions across 25 states. Last week, kicked off by hundreds of folks in front of DC, in front of the White House, led by leaders from the Appalachian region. We fought to, you know, continue to fight against the Mountain Valley Pipeline. We've been fighting for that for almost a decade, right? And many folks, dozens actually, risked arrest. And Representative Rashida Tlaib even joined us, right? And these actions are going to continue throughout the summer. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres will host a Climate Ambition Summit in New York this September. And the ticket to entry for that includes action to keep fossil fuels in the ground. We think this is a pivotal moment for President Biden as his disastrous approval of the Willow Project, the LNG projects in Alaska and the Gulf Coast, and the inclusion of the Mountain Valley Pipeline in debt ceiling negotiations are the opposite of what the UN has emphasized. It's necessary in order for us to address the climate crisis. So ahead of this summit, we'll be joining local and national groups across the country to call on President Biden to immediately deny permits for any fossil fuel projects, to phase out fossil fuels now by requiring a managed decline in oil and gas production, and to declare a climate emergency to unlock his additional powers and increase the availability of clean, renewable energy. So we're excited. Our movement is planning to mobilize tens of thousands of people to New York City during this UN Climate Week, demanding that Biden halt the approval of new fossil fuel infrastructure projects.
I mean, it was amazing to see those images of orange, hazy, smoke-filled air in New York City. I'm in Southern California, and unfortunately, we've seen this sort of and been impacted by wildfires every year as well, increasingly every year, people having to buy air purifiers and remain indoors at home. And as you mentioned, it's often low-income communities of color that are impacted, you know, who can't afford to install an air purifier in every classroom or every home, or work remotely and not have to commute to work, et cetera, right? That disproportionate impact against communities of color is often not part of the conversation in Washington, D.C., right? But your organization is emphasizing that.
Absolutely. As I mentioned, Black folks, working class folks, immigrant folks, we continue to be at the front lines and suffer the consequences of the greed from corporations who continue to pollute and destroy our planet. So we believe that the frontline folks, Black, Latinx, working class folks, immigrant folks, just have the solutions, right? We know that in order to, you know, cease the harm that fossil fuels are creating in this environment. We have to demand, we have to get Biden to demand a climate emergency and to end our reliance on fossil fuels.
Give out a website, Vaughn, where people can find out more about Center for Popular Democracy Action and any other place where they can find out about the actions this summer that maybe they can participate in.
Sure. You can find more information at populardemocracy.org.
I will post a link to that from our website as well. Vaughn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us, Sonali.
My guest is Vaughn Martin. They're the Deputy Chief of Campaigns at the Center for Popular Democracy Action. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website at risingupwithsonali.com. And you can find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. At a time when there are unprecedented means of peer-to-peer communications, people the world over are also, ironically, feeling disconnected and isolated. There are reports of the loneliness epidemic and the physical and mental toll it has. Well, today we'll turn to renowned expert Frank Ferencich, who has partnered with the climate organization Extinction Rebellion for a discussion about how purpose-driven activism can have a profound impact on personal well-being, resilience, and overall human integration. Frank Ferencich is co-creator of the training program Activism is Medicine. He's the author of several books, including the forthcoming book Activism is Medicine, Health and Relevance for the Human Animal. Welcome to the program, Frank.
Thanks. Great to be on with you.
Thanks so much for joining us. So it's certainly this issue that people are feeling lonely and disconnected. Some say that it's the pandemic that kind of kicked that off. But what is your analysis of why people feel so disconnected these days?
Right. Well, it's, I think, partly a response just to the overwhelming challenges that we face right now. And the fact that we're living essentially in an alien environment. Our history as animals has been a very different history, and now we've been plunged into the modern world in the blink of an eye, and the challenges we face for many of us are completely overwhelming. So we have social systems that are alien, we have stress that is just chronic, and the stress burden is overwhelming for so many people. So yes, we are challenged, and that's, I think, why we shrink back from activism in general, a lot of people.
What do you mean by activism? Let's define it. People imagine that maybe signing a petition is activism, or maybe they watch a documentary and that's activism, and then others are out in the streets and they are full-time activists. Is it everything in between? How do you define it?
Well, we talk about activism as a practice, as a path, as a way of life. It's a way of living in engagement with the world. So it's accepting responsibility for the world as it is and taking action. So on the flip side, complaining is not activism. Cheerleading other activists is not activism. Even protesting is not necessarily activism. It's more about our sense of responsibility and our willingness to expose ourselves to the world I think that's the key word here is exposure, because it's going outside of our comfort zones and taking on some of these challenges directly. It's a way of living.
Now, the capitalist system that we live in values money as the path to happiness, to meaning, pursuing money, pursuing success, pursuing promotions within one's career, even pursuing a career in and of itself is considered the sort of worthy thing to do, the measure of one's life. Is that antithetical to what you're talking about?
Yes, very much so. It's I think a lot of people now are starting to realize that that path is not satisfying and not sustainable. We need a new way of relating to the world and to one another. And the conventional measures of success are falling away. And so we're looking for something new, something that is meaningful. And this is the value of activism. There's plenty of research in the medical world talking about the power of having a sense of meaning and purpose and how that is actually a health positive effect on our bodies. So this is something that's even considered to be clinically significant. This is something that we should be asked about by our physicians, saying, are you engaged with the world? And unfortunately, we're not.
So there's maybe a bias in our culture about activism and activists. They're sort of seen as people who are perpetually tired, angry, frustrated. What is the science? What does the science show about the impact of an activist life on one's health?
Right. Well, as I say, there have been studies that show that people who have a sense of meaning and purpose do tend to live longer. They're more resilient. They're more resistant to various diseases and trauma and injury, the whole thing. And even outside of the world of science, if you go back to books like Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, his experience in a Nazi prisoner of war camp, he realized that the people who were most likely to survive were people who had a good sense of meaning and purpose. And this is something that's also recognized in Japanese culture. The word ikigai refers to the reason to get out of bed in the morning, basically. And people understand that having that sense of meaning and purpose is beneficial to our health, our longevity, and everything else. So this is where we can bring activism into the picture.
So being able to look at oneself in the mirror and feel proud of you spending time doing something worthwhile has an impact. Some even suggest that it might have an impact on a cellular level for us.
Oh, yeah, there's no question about that. As long as the activity that we're doing has some sense of coherence, some sense of meaning to it, then that has an integrating effect on the body. If you look at the body, it's a collection of systems. And what we call health is the synchronization of those systems. And we know how to synchronize those systems. We know that exercise, for example, has an integrating, synchronizing effect on all those systems in the body. And it's the same thing for activism. When we expose ourselves to the world, we put ourselves in a position of challenge. And that is a call to the body. It's saying, let's synchronize all these various subsystems of the body and work together. And that's exactly what happens. And you can very much make the comparison of exercise and activism. They're similar activities for the body.
It's funny, I've often thought about the fact that people who neglect their own health might say, well, I don't have time to exercise. And then the counter response from one's healthcare provider is often, well, you have to make time if you want to survive. And I've always thought of activism as, people saying, well, I don't have time to be an activist. Well, if you want our planet to survive and our species to survive, and I suppose even now one's own health to thrive, making time for activism is important. Does it matter if the activism is done in isolation versus in community?
Oh, it's very much a social activity. And that's one of the big health positives here, is that when you get involved in activism, you meet some very interesting people, people who are courageous, people who are standing up, people who are taking risks. And that in itself has a very health positive effect on the body. So yes, it's massively social. And in a sense, it doesn't even matter if you succeed in your personal, in whatever battle your group might be fighting. It's that sense of community is health positive.
So that leads me to the question of the fact that there can sometimes be a lot of hopelessness among activists because they have a goal, especially, you know, people who might be new to activism, who see something in their community, who get involved to try to stop it, and they end up not being able to stop it and feel hopeless. How do you respond to that?
Right. And that ties into this idea of learned helplessness. So when you take a creature, an animal, a human, and subject that animal to frequent failures where they don't have a sense of power and control, they eventually come around to the point where they assume helplessness, they assume defeat. And that is a hazard for activism, because we're up against these titanic forces and we do suffer a lot of defeats. And for me, the antidote here is artistic, creative activism. That always gives you an out, because even if you fail at your particular battle, you can still be creative. You can still come back the next day and say, okay, that thing didn't work. Let's create something that might work better. Let's keep our eye on the creativity. And that, I think, is a good antidote to this learned helplessness that we're vulnerable to.
Why do you refer to people as human animals?
Well, because I was trained as a biologist as an undergraduate, and I've been to Africa several times to study human history. And there's so much commonality that it's hard to avoid the conclusion that we are animals at our core. And everything that we do is a result of that animal nature. So to really understand people, to understand our behavior in the world, it helps to start with the animal orientation. And you can branch out from there, but the animal is fundamental. The animal is core to who we are.
I mean, we don't think of animals as needing to engage in activism to be healthy. What is the counter there? What's the analog?
Oh, well, I think animals do need to engage with the world. And for any animal to lapse into a state of passivity or compliance, that can be seen diagnostically as a sign of ill health in any animal. I mean, just look at the way your dog might behave. Mm. If your animal, your pet, your dog becomes apathetic about the world and stops engaging with the world, that's the sign of ill health. So yes, it's the same for all animals.
Often people will not know where to start. They might attend a speech given by an inspiring author and then think, well, what can I do? There is a sense of helplessness. To going back to what you were saying earlier, sometimes helplessness prevents us from engaging with the world. How do you respond to those who say, what can I do?
Right. Well, the way I put that, there is no single path to success as an activist. Really, there's 8 billion people in the world now. There's 8 billion possible pathways to activism. And it depends what your situation is, what your resources are. But the point is, you have to start doing something. This is something that you create as an artist going forward. And it may not be the most effective thing, but there has to be some kind of a doing and a trial and error process. So if you believe that you need to start going to a particular kind of meeting or writing particular kind of letters to people, and maybe that doesn't fit for you, well, try a different pathway. And it's very much an artistic creation. Try something. If that doesn't fit with you and your passion, then move on.
And then there's the other side where people pour so much of their lives into the activism that they disengage from their family. I've seen it so many times around me where people get very passionate about an issue. They give 150% of themselves. They forget to take, you know, do things like eat or go to the doctor. Is that the other extreme that you might warn against?
Right. And this is the warrior archetype because we're so willing to take on the responsibility, and we're so, to be honest, terrified about the state of the world right now that we're willing to work these long hours and to put our bodies on the back burner and to really push. But of course, that's not sustainable either. So yes, there has to be a balance. There has to be, going back to the animal, there has to be this acknowledgement of our animal selves and our health and taking care of that animal. Because if you don't, then you're not going to be effective in the long run. So yes, you have to do those things.
Right. So that balance, I guess that goes back to the issue of looking for or rebuilding community, rather. Because if you are in community, when there are failures, discussing those failures with the community that you battled alongside is also important, right? And can help you overcome those failures.
Right. All of those failures, those setbacks are much easier to bear in a group. And we are hypersocial animals, and that's how we're wired. And so, yes, it's hard to suffer failure as an individual, as an isolated person. So, yes, be part of that group. And
I'm wondering if we can talk about young people as we close our conversation. Young people and the climate crisis. There's so much depression among teenagers and even younger than that. I've seen it. There's a lot of articles about it, and there's an epidemic these days around that. There's also a feeling of helplessness. A lot of young folks are, you know, looking to the older generations going, look at the state of the earth you have left us. It feels hopeless to think about us not being able to have a future with climate catastrophe all around us. What advice would you give a young person today?
Right. Well, I work with a group here in Bend, Oregon, Fridays for Future. And of course, you've heard of Greta Thunberg, and that's her group. And for me, it's very much the case that these kids have to take the risk of being engaged, because the challenges ahead of them are so immense and so overwhelming that to withdraw at this point just isn't going to make any sense. It's just not going to help. And the fight is essential. Taking some kind of, you might say, martial artistry going forward is going to be vital for their health and their mental health as well. It's really, you hear a lot of people now say that action is the antidote to despair, and that's very much true. We have to take whatever risk we can to maintain a habitable planet and to maintain a future. So that's why I'm so excited to work with these young people and to encourage them to keep moving.
When does your book come out, Activism as Medicine?
Oh, it'll be late this year, maybe early next year. It'll be a short book. I'm really excited about it. It's a very health positive vision of activism, and I'm really looking forward to sharing that with the world.
Give out a website, Frank, for your work.
Yes, a couple of websites. One is called humananimal.earth, and the other one is activismismedicine.net.
And we'll post links to both of those from our site. Thank you so much, and good luck to you.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
My guest has been Frank Ferencic, a co-creator of the training program Activism is Medicine, author of several books, including the forthcoming Activism is Medicine, Health and Relevance for the Human Animal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com. By becoming a subscriber, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
Broadcasting from the Hip Hop Weekly Studios, I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Civic Cypher. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is Ramses Ja, and he speaks so eloquently. Don't you agree? Do you hear the velvet in it? Okay, I'm sorry. Sometimes I get a little carried away, but his tone is just so... Anyway, he's Ramses Ja. I am